When Ashcroft, a longtime favorite of the religious right, had explored seeking the presidency in 1997 and 1998, most of his financial support came from Christian evangelicals such as Pat Robertson. Conservatives subsequently mobilized in favor of his selection as Attorney General. Son and grandson of Pentecostal preachers, Ashcroft, more than any previous Attorney General, viewed law and politics through a religious lens. He made no effort to shade this connection. In Ashcroft's memoirs, explained one critic, he describes each of his many electoral defeats as a crucifixion and every important political victory as a resurrection, and recounts scenes in which he had friends and family anoint him with oil in the manner of the ancient kings of Israel with each new public office. While in the Senate, Ashcroft enjoyed a 100% approval rating from both the Christian Coalition and the National Right to Life Committee, pleasing the latter by sponsoring a constitutional amendment that extended protection to the unborn at every stage of their biological development, including fertilization, a breadth that might have criminalized birth control. As Attorney General, the Missourian was accused of dragging his heels on the prosecution of abortion clinic bombers. Earlier in his political career, Ashcroft had decried the barrier between church and state as a wall of religious oppression. Midway through the first Bush administration, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a liberal group, condemned his actions as Attorney General. "Whenever cases deal with government funding or promotion of religion," said its spokesperson, "the Justice Department under Ashcroft is always on the side of bringing church and state together." Perhaps, but it is also fair to say that Bush's religious constituencies thrill to the criticisms of such hostile groups. During Ashcroft's time in the Senate, he had also authored successful legislation to let states turn over welfare and other social services to religious providers, a program that George W. Bush embraced as governor of Texas and which helped to inspire his 2001 proposal for federal faith-based initiatives. Where possible, religious agencies would take over the provision of federal social services. When Bush's legislation stalled in the Senate, he used a federal executive order to establish faith-based initiative units in six departments: Justice, Education, Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, Labor, and Agriculture, as well as in the Agency for International Development. At the General Services Administration, the office maintenance arm of the federal government, Bush appointees held lunch hour revival meetings in the front hall, making it seem, in the words of the Washington Post, more like the foyer of a Pentecostal storefront church. The House and Senate lobbies had some of that same look. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay and Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe, chairman of the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works, were two who insisted that all the answers were in the Bible, and two-thirds of Republican House and Senate members enjoyed 80% or better voting ratings from groups such as the Christian Coalition, the Traditional Values Coalition, the National Right to Life Committee, and the Family Research Council. Dozens of legislators anxious to be theologically correct competed to maintain perfect ratings. As for the interaction of church and state in the White House, two characterizations peculiar to George W. Bush. His salute from several religious right leaders in 2001 as the national head of their movement and his seeming self-image as someone who spoke for God added to the perception of a unique presidency. That a chief executive could be described in these ways without sparking a heated national debate bespoke the public's willingness to accept religion and authority in the aftermath of September 11th. The way in which Bush White House policies were the application of hardline, preformed doctrine rather than the results of evidence-seeking was explained by two departing and disillusioned officials. Former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill recalled his dismay that ideology dwarfed real-world analysis. "Ideology is a lot easier, because you don't have to know anything or search for anything. You already know the answer to everything. It's not penetrable by facts." John DiIulio, the first head of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, ruefully described the complete lack of a policy apparatus or meaningful, substantive policy discussions, because everything was political, with much of the policy coming from right-wing think tanks and the Christian right. The president was most comfortable with black and white, good versus evil portraiture, acknowledging that nuance was not in his playbook. Anti-intellectualism, which profited George Wallace so much in his 1968 presidential campaign, became a Bush prop too, as in his mockery of high grades during a visit to Yale, his alma mater, to receive an honorary degree in 2002. An unidentified senior administration official dismissed the intellectual elites, what we call the reality-based community, people who believe that solutions emerge from your judicious study of discernible reality. In the Oval Office, instinct, prayer, and faith took precedence.